and Amazon warehouse workers in Staten Island appear to have successfully formed a union, the first in the United States for the giant logistics company. The National Labor Relations Board said the election tallied over 2,600 votes for the Amazon Labor Union and just over 2,100 against. With only 67 challenged ballots, the union's victory is all but guaranteed. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 56 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 53 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
This week on COVID Race and Democracy.
In Staten Island, they went on strike. They took actions. They got the attorney general of the state involved, you know, calling out the company and getting, and they got workers reinstated. They fought. They acted like a union before they were an official union.
Amazon Staten Island workers win a historic victory in their unionization effort.
We have to keep asking ourselves, like, who is profiting from this conflict? And, you know, what is going on with the ruling class? This is a ruling class conflict. This is not a conflict between working people.
Liz Medina, the Vermont AFL-CIO executive director on the Ukraine war and the working class.
It was a very wonky kind of show that if we had a functioning public broadcasting system would have been on probably very late at night. But of course we don't, because they are as beholden to wealthy donors and corporations as the commercial media.
Author Chris Hedges on censorship of his RT show by Google.
We visited IDP camps near the front lines, which were filled with Ago people, a subset of the Amhara, who had fled the TPLF forces in the border regions. They had very little food or water, no medicines, and no sanitation facilities. At two of the three camps we visited, they were sleeping on hard ground without even the thin mattresses we saw in the first. One after another, they told us that the TPLF had taken everything they had.
Pacifica's Ann Garrison reports from internally displaced persons camps in Ethiopia and more. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. We began today's show covering the historic victory of the Amazon Staten Island workers who voted for representation by the Amazon Workers Union, AWU. Pacifica talked with labor journalist Mike Elk of PaydayReport.com.
We're talking today with Mike Elk. There's been a very significant development, first in the United States, of a union election in which the workers won the election at Amazon Staten Island. And Mike has been covering it. He's with paydayreport.com and has been active covering the Bessemer struggle as well. We want to talk to him today about the lessons at Bessemer and why they were able to get a victory at Staten Island. So welcome, Mike.
You know, this is a huge victory for the labor movement. I mean, you can hear the tectonic plates of the labor movement shifting. You know, there's such a deep labor establishment and labor intelligentsia and labor bureaucracy, which says these kind of victories can't happen, particularly since this was a victory by an independent union, right? This was a union that was crowdfunded, that was funded directly by workers, that was formed by workers who were involved in a wildcat strike 2 years ago against, you know, unsafe COVID practices. You know, Christian Smalls was fired during that strike and he became the president of the union. A lot of people wrote this off. Christian Smalls even called out Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez last night for abandoning the effort there. So, you know, this is a big, big, big deal. And I think it's going to raise a lot of questions. I mean, unions have been spending a lot of money for a lot of years to raise unions. And here's this sort of self-started union that went out and did it on their own. And I think it really raises a deep question, which is, look, unions are huge bureaucracies. People don't trust bureaucracy. When folks form an independent union, they feel like, oh, yeah, we have some ownership over this. This is something we built. And I think we've seen the success of this model here in Staten Island. To win a 5,000-person warehouse, I mean, the Teamsters sometimes spend millions of dollars trying to do this and fail.
And what did they do differently? Because you did cover the defeat at Bessemer. Why don't you compare the Bessemer experience, and they were defeated again, apparently, although they're challenging it, with the what they did right in Staten Island?
Well, I think the big difference there is that in Staten Island, they went on strike. They took actions. They got the attorney general of the state involved in, you know, calling out the company and getting, and they got workers reinstated. They fought. They acted like a union before they were an official union. And this was the key. And they were out there every day serving food. And it wasn't, you know, because I went down there to Bessemer and it was paid union staff out there acting in a very generic way, telling people. One of the guys said at one point, one of the union organizers with RWDSU said, you know, a union's like an insurance policy. You only know it's there when you get in trouble. That's the wrong mentality of a union. And I think we've seen a big win here in Staten Island that's going to shake up how people talk about things.
And the company now is also being charged with trying to thwart the workers' efforts, violating the rules, even though they were already acted against by NLRB for violating the last election. It seems like they have contempt for the labor laws, and actually they did many of the similar things to prevent the workers from voting for the union.
Yeah, you know, they fired folks. It backfired big time when they called the cops on workers that were trying to deliver food to Amazon workers. You know, there were a lot of mistakes the company made. And I think the biggest mistake they made was underestimating how much they would spend. One of the workers, Christian Smalls, who's the president of the union, joked that while Jeff Bezos was up in space, we were down here organizing.
And, you know, these companies, Bezos company, conspired with their lawyers to thwart democratic rights. I mean, these law firms, they spent millions on these law firms, and they're actually conspiring how to prevent workers to have the rights. Do you think that should be prosecuted? I mean, it seems like if I was conspiring to violate the laws, you would be attacked by the government. But it seems like they have impunity, and there's no prosecution of them for a conspiracy to violate labor laws, to fire workers and illegally take away your rights.
You know, my father, who was a union organizer for UE for many years, used to joke, you know, the penalty for, firing a worker, you have to post a piece of paper. The penalty for bank robbing was you had to post a piece of paper. We'd all be bank robbers. I'd go rob a bank this afternoon if I could pull it off. So, you know, it's pretty fascinating to see this all, to see workers overcome that. And I think when workers feel like they really own a union, then they feel like, you know, they can really do something. And really want to risk their neck. Nobody wants to risk their neck for a bureaucracy.
And Stuart Applebaum, who is with the Retail Workers Union, that Retail Wholesale Department Store Workers Union, was also elected to the board of the National Endowment for Democracy, which is giving $75 million a year to the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center. They called him a labor activist. What's Stuart Applebaum's role in what is happening in Bessemer?
He's the leader of the union drive down there. They didn't invest a lot of resources in the first one. They didn't take militant action. He's been involved in that. A nice person. But I think it's interesting, you know.
And this latest effort, it seems like the AFL-CIO did not mobilize nationally as they did around the first campaign. There's no national campaign to back them up. It seems like they kind of just puttered out. I mean, and that's why it's a kind of a shock to about what happened.
Yeah, I think it certainly puttered out. I don't think it was much of a shock that they lost there. I could have told you that based on the fact they weren't doing much. But we are going to need a national campaign to get a union contract at Staten Island. This is going to be a very tough fight. It's going to be I think if you look at what happened though with Starbucks, where they built this sort of organic uprising, I think it shows that it's very possible.
The Teamsters now want to work with other unions and others to organize Amazon around the country. How do you think that should go with the lessons of Staten Island and an independent union?
I think we have to really start looking at models like UE. We have to really, I think you're starting to see somewhat of a union democracy movement. There were some Teamsters reformers. I don't want to call those guys saints because they're not the people that took over. The Teamsters for Democratic Union crowd isn't very democratic anymore, but they're trying to do slightly better than the Hoffa people did. And so certainly this sort of raises the ante for them. It raises the antes for them to do more. And, you know, today the Teamsters came out and said, you know, they're going to invest a lot. So I think we're going to see a lot more organizing.
And this issue of democracy, you've said that this is a democratic union that was formed by Christian Smalls and others. How do you see that taking place in the labor movement as a whole? Because you have a corporate type structure in a lot of unions, top down, as you had in the Bessemer thing. I mean, it seems like that's the structure that really dominates the labor movement at this point.
I think that's a good point, is that, you know, it's going to lead to huge reform of those kind of models. I think it's going to raise a lot of questions. I think you're going to see a lot more workers wanting to, you know, try independent unions. And maybe after they unionize, think about organizing with someone. I mean, you know, the big argument that I think a lot of unions make for why they want to go with a big union is, oh, we can pay for all these lawyers. Well, you know, if you're relying on broken labor law to organize, you're losing already.
It's a long wait.
Yeah.
And you and your paydayreport.com, you've been covering this as an independent journalist. What's the role of independent labor media? Because you've been in a fight to defend independent labor journalists, and it seems like there are more labor journalists growing around the country, getting support because of the stories.
We need independent labor media. Look, none of the, you know, so much of the labor media is bought and paid for by the union leadership. None of them saw this coming, right? And I think that's exactly why you need independent labor media that's willing to go out there and say, hey, this is happening. It's a big deal. And it's something that we need to be paying attention to. We saw this during the strike wave. You know, we were recognized by Project Censored because we predicted the strike wave 18 months out. The AFL-CIO was literally sending around articles saying the strike wave isn't happening and these guys are lying about their numbers, right? So, you know, I think it raises some questions of just how incompetent the labor movement is.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking with Mike Elk, a labor journalist at paydayreport.com, was on this covering the Staten Island and was optimistic it would happen when most of the corporate media, of course, were silent and most people found it unexpected. So thanks for joining us, Mike.
Thanks.
That was Pacifica Steve Zeltzer speaking to Mike Elk, a labor reporter with paydayreporter.com.
Wake up, all you builders, time to build a new land.
Toby Nwegwe, wake up everybody. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The issue of Ukraine has yet to become a debate within labor, and most national unions, such as the AFL-CIO, are only blaming Russia without mentioning the role of the United States in surrounding Russia by the massive expansion of NATO. At a recent labor education panel, Liz Medina, the Vermont AFL-CIO executive director, talked about the Ukraine war, the working class, and organized labor.
I'm really glad that we are having this discussion today because wars and conflicts affect working people everywhere. I'm mainly here today to talk about what this conflict is doing to working people in Ukraine, in Russia, and even here in the United States. And of course, in Ukraine, the Ukrainian people are facing the worst of it. There's a huge humanitarian crisis. They're being killed and harmed, and it's a really dire situation that we can only imagine here from our comforts of our homes here in the U.S. But there's also, of course, a lot of political repression and sanctions that are affecting working people in those states as well, in Ukraine and Russia. So, you know, and for instance, in Russia, hundreds of anti-war protesters have been jailed. In Ukraine, Zelensky has banned pretty much all the left-wing parties, and neo-Nazi groups control the streets in the Ukraine and have formal positions in the military and administration, which is pretty frightening and not a good sign for the working classes there. So, you know, there's a lot of other things that are happening as a result of this conflict that we won't know or really figure out the implications of for some time. For instance, there is, you know, going to be probably rising food prices. As Ukraine is a main producer of wheat, there's going to be, we're already seeing rising gas prices and the bonanza for oil companies. We're going to see food prices also rise because Russia is a huge producer of fertilizer, about 12% of our fertilizer in potash. We are seeing a really kind of frightening level of censorship here in the U.S. Just recently, I heard that Chris Hedges' entire RT archive was pulled from YouTube. And, you know, we're going to probably see more of like this kind of censorship Patriot Act redux going on. And what's happening with the global economy as well, that, you know, we have to keep track of and think about too. I recently saw that Russia tied its currency, rubles, to gold. That is a more secure currency than a fiat currency, such as U.S. dollars, which is the global reserve. And we could see, you know, in response to the sanctions that we thought were going to hurt Russia, Russia is securing their money. And we could see countries in the future abandoning the U.S. dollar. And so, you know, we have to keep asking ourselves, like, who is profiting from this conflict? And, you know, what is going on with the ruling class? This is a ruling class conflict. This is not a conflict between working people. All right. I mean, Eugene Debs, I think, said it best back in 1918 when he said, in the Middle Ages, when feudal lords concluded to enlarge their domains, to increase their power, their prestige and their wealth, they declared war upon one another. But they themselves did not go to war any more than the modern feudal lords, the barons of Wall Street, go to war. So, you know, what is happening with the global oligarchs is not just Russian oligarchs. It's oligarchs in Ukraine. It's oligarchs in the United States. It's oligarchs in the European Union. What is happening? What is that? How is that affecting us? And who's profiting? Obviously, we can see already that oil companies are profiting immensely. The military industrial complex is profiting immensely. Raytheon CEO Greg Hayes, you know, is talking and salivating over the tensions in Eastern Europe in an earnings call. Lockheed Martin CEO is also excited about this conflict and the great power competition, in his words, that is going to benefit his company immensely. And so, you know, this is a conflict among the ruling classes. We have to remember that. And we need to be thinking about what are they trying to achieve? What is happening? And in terms of solutions, I mean, I'm not an expert at any of this. I'm not a foreign policy expert, but it seems to me that the only solution in terms of saving the most lives and not using Ukrainians as a proxy war against Russia, and, you know, at the same time, you know, maybe not capitulating to Russia, is to try to use U.S. power in NATO, for instance, and other organizations to diffuse tensions, to try to de-escalate and not provide more weapons, because right now we don't know where those weapons are going to end up. There's a long history of U.S. providing weapons in conflicts and giving them to extremist groups in conflicts and having long destabilizing effects in those countries. And we cannot risk that with the degree of neo-Nazi activity in Ukraine right now. And I know, you know, Russia is using that to a certain extent as a premise for this war. And it's not to justify the war by any means, but it is a problem and we can't ignore it. And I think we should also be petitioning our government's huge role in organizations like the IMF to demand cancellation of Ukraine debt. We are the biggest contributor to the IMF, so we have considerable sway in this organization. And economic instability is what leads to conflicts, oftentimes what leads to the rise in fascism. There's going to be a massive need to rebuild the country after this war is over with. And we need to make it easier, not harder, for them to rebuild and not be saddled with even more debt after this conflict. And we can do that by canceling that debt. And of course, we also need to give as any kind of humanitarian aid and offer refugee resettlement. And I'm glad that we have announced that we're accepting 100,000, I believe, Ukrainian refugees. Absolutely need to do that. At the same time, I think we need to have a broader conversation about why it is that we are so accepting of certain refugees and not others. I think and it's overdue for us to have a conversation about the need to accept refugees from other countries that we have stoked conflicts in, such as Syria, Palestine, and Yemen, to name but a few. And, you know, last but not least, I think we really need to demand that our country stop, exacerbating and bringing about conflict in other countries. I was really disappointed by President Biden's words about wanting a regime change in Russia. Of course, I find Putin's actions and the military intervention abhorrent, but I think we have no role in deciding what should happen in terms of that country per se. It's up to the Russian people to decide how they want to deal with their country and the conflict. A lot of them have been standing up against the war, but we need to stop trying to be the cop of the world and try our best to instead facilitate peace and invest our money in people and providing for people's needs instead of killing them in mass numbers for various geopolitical conflicts that only benefit a few.
That was Vermont AFL-CIO Executive Director Liz Medina.
Back when Eisenhower was the president, golf courses is where most of his time was spent. So I never really listened to what the president said, because in general, I believed that the general was politically dead. But he always seemed to know when the muscles were about to be flexed. Because I remember him saying something, mumbling something about a military-industrial complex. Americans no longer fight to keep their shores safe, just to keep the jobs going in the arms-making workplace. And then they pretend to be gripped by some sort of political reflex. But all they're doing is paying dues to the military-industrial complex. The military and the monetary. The military and the monetary. The military and the monetary. The military and the monetary get together whenever they think it's necessary. They turn our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet to a cemetery. The military and the monetary use the media as intermediaries. They are determined to keep the citizens secondary. They make so many decisions that are arbitrary. We're marching behind the commander-in-chief, who was standing under a spotlight shaking like a leaf. But the ship of state had landed on an economic reef, so we knew he was going to bring us messages of grief. The military and the monetary were shielded by January and went storming into February. Brought us pot-bellied generals as luminaries. 2 weeks ago, I hadn't heard of some, and all of a sudden, he's legendary. They took the honor from the honorary. They took the dignity from the dignitaries. They took the secrets from the secretary, but they left an obituary.
The legendary Gil Scott-Heron, Work for Peace. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The U.S. Congress has appropriated billions of dollars for the war in Ukraine. At the same time, uninsured Americans will now have to start paying for their COVID treatment. The growing economic costs of this war was examined by two leading economists, Richard Wolf, and Michael Hudson on Consortium News Live with Joe Lauria and Elizabeth Voss. Professor Richard Wolf is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the Mass Amherst and a visiting professor at the New School in New York. Professor Michael Hudson is Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and a researcher at the Levi Economics Institute at Bard College. Here is part of their conversation.
I'm very leery of the attempt too closely to link the inflation here in the United States to Ukraine. All that the Ukraine is doing is maybe making it worse, making it last a little longer. But everyone needs to remember that the inflation was well underway before February 24th when Russia moved into Ukraine. So it cannot be, although it is already being blamed in some sense, it allows a connection to be made that somehow the domestic inflation is Russia's fault along with everything else that is attributed to Russia. We have an economy that is in very deep trouble. Mr. Biden, as the presiding president, has to keep saying it's really okay. This is silly. You know, Trump, when he was running against the Democrats for president, said that their claims the economy was great were all bogus. As soon as he became president, the Democrats accused him of being bogus about his celebration. They were right again, just as he had been right before. And now we have to play that role against Mr. Biden. And the Republicans, no doubt, will do that as well. But that's very superficial. That doesn't get at anything. We have an economy that is extraordinary from the point of view of both classes, the employer class on the one hand and the employee class on the other. For the employees, I mean, think about it. The years 2020 and 2021 could be argued as among the worst for the working class in American history. They suffered two catastrophes, a public health disaster as big or bigger than any in American history, and the arguably second worst economic collapse. A little statistic, more than 80 million Americans had unemployment for some part of the last 2 years, some for only a couple of weeks, some for the whole period. But that's more than half the working class. That's more than half the labor force of this country. That means everybody, 50% of our working class, experienced unemployment. And it's spectacular what was done to these people across 2 years. And then, as they think, and we don't even know if it's true yet, that they're emerging from the pandemic and all of that, they get slapped across the face with an inflation running now officially at 8% and likely at least 2 or 3% worse than that if you take into account how the numbers are calculated and so on. This is an extraordinary level of pain to inflict on a working class. And you know it because just this week, the release of the findings of the University of Michigan Survey of Consumers indicates, for example, 32% of Americans think right now that their economic future is worse than the condition they're in today. That's the worst number in that survey since it started in the 1940s. We've seen a catastrophic experience while the president, who slips and says regime change is on the agenda, tells us about a robust economic recovery. I mean, it's not me that's questioning it. Those surveys of the University of Michigan indicate that the American people must believe that Mr. Biden is off his rocker with this kind of talk. What is the world is he talking about? So when the American people being squeezed watch huge sums of money shipped off to the Ukraine, and with all due respect, Americans are feeling for the pain and the suffering of the people going through war. I understand that. My family has gone through war. I know that real well. But they're going, as they think about it, to wonder about billions over there, and we don't have what here in terms of our situation. It is an extraordinary time.
Go ahead, Michael.
I think the implication of what Rick says is that President Biden indeed got a regime change, but the regime change is in the United States itself. When Biden said last week, well, America's got to make a lot of great sacrifices, but who's the we? The sacrifices that the public is making, as Rick has explained, the sacrifices he's talking about are huge, huge profits for the oil companies. Look at the stock market, soaring for the oil companies. Look at Raytheon and the military-industrial complex and Boeing, soaring prices. And what he describes as a disaster for the American consumers that are squeezed is a bonanza for centralized capital. Last night on the news and here in New York City, they had a listing by boroughs of the evictions that are taking place. If you can't meet your basic budget of covering your fuel costs, utility costs, your food costs, you're going to be behind in your payments. And a lot of people are going to lose their homes, either their renters or even owners. There is a huge agglomeration of private capital companies waiting to come in and pick up all of this real estate and turn America away from an owner-occupied economy into a rental economy, a landlord economy. Biden really may succeed in rolling back the economy to the mid-19th century. That basically is not just Biden, of course, it's the people around him. And ultimately, it's the deep state. Whether you're a Republican or the Democrats, their policy is identical. They have the same campaign contributors. And I'm sure Rick agrees with that. All that voters can do is keep throwing the rascals out of power, but they're the same rascals, basically. So the United States doesn't seem to have much of an opportunity to have a real alternative. And you'd mentioned the absence of an anti-war demonstration. There isn't any anti-war demonstration here or in Europe. In Europe, the only anti-war demonstrations are the nationalist right wing. The whole left wing in Europe has been so corrupted by CIA meddling in the National Endowment for Democracy, basically turning the labor parties into Tony Blair, the Blairism, and social democracy into neoliberalism, that the only protest you're getting is not from the left at all, it's from the right. So the hope for the change is going to be the model that you're having basically in China and Central Asia, finally saying we are not going to let American finance dictate how our society develops. We're going to develop our society for the population as a whole. So Western democracy has not been very successful in creating this prosperity. It looks like you need a government strong enough to check financial power and strong enough to check the power of the 1%. And that's not being done under Western democracy.
We just heard from economists Michael Hudson and Richard Wolff of Consortium News, live with Joe Lauria and Elizabeth Voss. Classic music by Edwin Starr, War, What Is It Good For? There are many other wars around the world, but they are not getting the same focus as Ukraine. COVID race and democracy producer Ann Garrison is now in Ethiopia and reports on the ground from internally displaced persons camps in Ethiopia.
The Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, is a long-standing ally of the U.S. They started Ethiopia's Tigray War by attacking the National Army's 5 northern command bases in November 2020. Ever since, the Western state and corporate press have reported that the Ethiopian government and army are blocking humanitarian aid trucks from entering Tigray to respond to a humanitarian crisis, even though more than 1,000 aid trucks have simply disappeared into Tigray. They report that the government is denying Tigray electricity and medicines. Tedros Adhanom, foreign minister of the former TPLF government and director general of the World Health Organization, cries out for humanitarian aid to Tigray without mentioning the immense suffering in Amhara and Afar regions, both of which were invaded by the TPLF. The TPLF invaded Amhara after the government declared a unilateral ceasefire in June 2021, and they are still holding its northernmost regions. We were told that in Alamada, they incapacitated the substation, shutting down electricity and therefore plumbing in 9 cities in the northern Amhara region. We were not able to visit Alamada because the TPLF still control it, but we can confirm that there was neither electricity nor plumbing in the 2 cities we visited, including the holy city of Lalibela, home of the rock-hewn Ethiopian Orthodox churches created during the 12th century. We visited IDP camps near the front lines, which were filled with Ago people, a subset of the Amhara, who had fled the TPLF forces in the border regions. They had very little food or water, no medicines, and no sanitation facilities. At 2 of the 3 camps we visited, they were sleeping on hard ground without even the thin mattresses we saw in the first. One after another, they told us that the TPLF had taken everything they had, and they had finally fled for their lives. Here are voices of internally displaced Amhara people in Wole IDP camp.
When they come, their house is already burned with the TPLF. And after they come here, they didn't get any food, any material, any food supplies. So they need to tell for the world is just to get food properly in this place. And the main thing is just to make a peace, and they want to return back to home. At this time, we are suffering with droughts. We don't get enough help from the government or from the NGO. This place is very difficult place, and most of the people are sick.
We need peace and food, and we need to back to our home again.
Here are voices of internally displaced Amhara in Metek IDP camp.
She's living in Abergele, near to the border of Tigray.
Yes.
And she has been living for a while there. But now with the conflict of junta in Ethiopia, she is coming just here to save her life. And when they come here, they don't get what they need. Even they don't get the mattress to sleep and any material to eat, to drink. They don't get anything. The first thing is peace. If not, we would like to join the military and we would like to fight with them. Because this is the end. After this, we don't have anything. So, if there is peace, that's nice. If not, we would like to join the military.
Those were voices of internally displaced Amhara people who fled from their homes to escape the TPLF. In Lalibela, Amhara region, Ethiopia, I'm Ann Garrison.
Music by Ethiopian artist Teddy Afro. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. One of the costs of the war in Ukraine is the closure of the Russian-U.S. TV affiliate RT America. Not only was it closed, but the programmer's entire show collections were removed by YouTube, which is owned by Google. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke with writer and critic Chris Hedges about the erasure of all his shows from YouTube and the suppression of free speech in the U.S.
So, Chris, you have been a foremost critic in the United States against U.S. imperialist policy around the world, and you had a program on RT. Why don't you talk about that and what happened to it, and most recently, the deletion of your tapes?
Right. So I had a television show on Telesur called Days of Revolt. Telesur crashed and burned with the collapse of the Venezuelan economy and the change in governments in countries like Argentina that became right wing and no longer wanted to fund Telesur. And then RT approached me about resurrecting the show, rebranding it, calling it another name. Which I agreed to as long as I had editorial control, which I did. They were true to their word. For 6 years, it was primarily a show that interviewed authors. As a writer, I don't like being interviewed by people who don't read the book. I appreciate people who have taken the time to read what I've written. So I was very conscientious about reading the books. I interviewed leading intellectuals, Cornel West, Noam Chomsky, Slavoj Žižek, Wendy Brown, Gerald Horn, and others. And it was a very wonky kind of show that if we had a functioning public broadcasting system would have been on probably very late at night. But of course we don't, because they are as beholden to wealthy donors and corporations as the commercial media. I had been pushed out of the New York Times because of my denunciations of the call to invade Iraq. I'd been the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I spent 7 years in the Middle East. I'm a very public supporter of the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, which alone will get you blacklisted. It saw my good friend Cornel West denied tenure at Harvard, I think primarily over that issue. So there's fewer and fewer places someone like me can go as a critic of both parties, the corporate control of the Democratic and Republican parties, my critiques of militarism and the surveillance state. And RT gave me that space. Why? Well, because they like to amplify fierce critics of the United States. And of course, we do the same. When I worked in Eastern Europe, I covered the revolution in Czechoslovakia, was in the Magic Lantern Theater every night with Václav Havel, who I knew. And if you wanted to hear Havel, you had to listen to Voice of America. Havel had no more love for the policies of Washington than I had for Moscow. Now, with the invasion of Ukraine, I spoke out again quite publicly against the invasion, calling it, as it was, for an act of preemptive war, which under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression. It was precisely that denunciation of our war in Iraq that got me into trouble with the New York Times. But of course, it would be hypocritical to see Russia carry out the same crime and not speak out against it. With this caveat, the invasion of Iraq was based on fabrications and lies. I was in Eastern Europe, as I said, in 1989 as a reporter with the breakup of the Soviet Union. And so I was well aware that Western governments, including the U.S. government, Margaret Thatcher, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, then the foreign minister of Germany, promised Gorbachev that NATO would not be expanded beyond the borders of a unified Germany, a promise that they broke. The Clinton administration promised the Russian government that it would not station NATO troops in Central and Eastern Europe, a promise it broke. We now have, 13 or 14 Eastern and Central European countries integrated into NATO. It never made any geopolitical sense. In fact, in 1989, we all thought NATO was obsolete. It was created as an instrument to prevent Soviet expansion into Central and Eastern Europe. But of course, that wasn't the case. NATO was expanded because it was a multi-billion dollar a year bonanza for the arms industry. I was in Warsaw not long ago. There were billboards all around the city for Raytheon, because Raytheon is, of course, bilking the Polish people. Poland just signed a $6 billion contract to buy M1 Abrams tanks. And just on the issue of Ukraine, is a de facto NATO country, not in name, but in terms of the weaponry, the NATO weaponry that has poured into the Ukraine, along with, I think there were 150 NATO military advisors in the Ukraine before Russia attacked. That's not in any way to excuse what Russia did, but it is to say that they were provoked, and there was uniformity across the political spectrum, whether it was Henry Kissinger or George Kennan or anyone else, that the expansion of NATO was very foolish. In fact, Kennan lived long enough to call it the greatest mistake of the Cold War. But speak in that kind of nuance, engage in that kind of criticism, and there's, of course, very few places you can go. And now they've shut down RT. RT was shut down 6 days after I issued my public denunciation of the war.
And that was the first time I saw you mentioned in the New York Times. They had an article on the shutdown of RT. They mentioned Chris Hedges, their former journalist, head man, and he gets a mention.
Right. And so 6 days later, RT goes dark. And then I don't know what day it was. I was in London for Julian Assange's wedding. I came back and a friend of mine texted me to say that the show he was in was no longer on YouTube. So I went on YouTube and none of the shows, six years, 300 plus shows gone, vanished. Not one of which had anything to do with Russia. In fact, the very few times that Russia was mentioned, or Putin was mentioned, was in very unflattering terms. Matt Taibbi linked to one of the shows with Alan Naren, where he kind of excoriated Moscow for war crimes in Syria. So we know why they took it off. The 2017 Director of National Intelligence report devoted seven pages to RT. They were explicit as to what it was they didn't like on RT, and it wasn't Russian propaganda. It was the fact that RT gave a platform to anti-fracking activists, Occupy activists, Black Lives Matter activists, third-party candidates, anti-imperialists. So I think they kind of tipped their hand, and that's why I was disappeared off of YouTube, and that's why RT doesn't exist.
And it seems like in war, the first thing to go is free speech and the right of people to get opponent views out, different views out. And it seems like the stepping up by the corporate tech companies to shut down any dissenting views is an example of their kind of united front to stop any debate or any question of U.S. Policy.
Well, the worst cheerleaders are most enthusiastic for censorship are the Democrats. So they've held hearings in Washington, dragged in the CEOs from these social media companies and demanded more censorship. They engaged in censorship during the last campaign between Biden and Trump. The Twitter locked the New York Post out of its own Twitter account because it had revealed the contents of Hunter Biden's laptop. The rest of the media called it, out of a Russian playbook. The New York Times called it disinformation. It wasn't disinformation. Even the Bidens didn't deny that the contents were real. It was verified information, but it would have potentially hurt the Biden campaign. And so there was a very energetic effort to cover it up and or discredit it. You saw Silicon Valley in the last few weeks of the campaign spend hundreds of millions of dollars. We don't know how much because it was dark money producing negative ads against Trump for the Biden administration. And the quid pro quo, of course, is that the Democrats will not break up these monopolies. So there is a collusion now between the establishment. It's not just the Democratic establishment, because the old Republican establishment has now fused with the Democratic Party. Figures like Liz Cheney, Mitt Romney, Bill Kristol, all these figures in opposition to the kind of cult-like following that has deformed the Republican Party. Now, I don't like these gun-toting militias and Christian fascists and QAnon conspiracy theorists any more than anyone else. But we're not going to, and these are really the products of the assault on the working class. These political distortions grew out of neoliberalism and deindustrialization and trade deals and the slashing of social services, you know, the gutting of welfare and everything else. So we're not going to bring back some kind of political health by banishing their voices. I was opposed to, was on Democracy Now, and oppose removing Trump from the Twitter account, his social media accounts, because if you give these private entities, these opaque entities, about which we know nothing, and of course they know everything about us, that power of wholesale censorship, I knew it wouldn't stop for Trump. With Trump, what I didn't expect is that I would so soon afterwards be a victim myself. But this is a world we really don't want to inhabit.
And there is a growth of a working class movement. The Amazon workers won a tremendous victory in New York. It seems like workers are waking up in the United States, and the need for an alternative media network for yourself and others, where you can have uncensored viewpoints of working class struggle and others who question American imperialism, is absolutely necessary. How do you see that taking place? Because right now, outside of Pacifica, there is no alternative media platform.
Right. That's right. Pacifica is under a lot of stress. I've gone to Substack, like Glenn Greenwald and Matt Taibbi, which is chrishedges.substack.com. If I get enough subscribers, it in essence allows me to continue to write my weekly column, which is on SharePost on Mondays, and reconstitute my television show. And for now, that's about the only model that I've got. I mean, Bob does a magnificent job running SharePost, but he doesn't have any money. He's kind of trying to make it work out of his Social Security check. So
we're back in the old days.
Yeah. So, well, he never raised much money for Ramparts either. It's not surprisingly. I mean, in fact, there's quite an amusing story of him taking a Pan Am Airlines ad off the back of Time magazine or something and put it on the back of Ramparts and then taking it around to advertisers to show he was respectable, the result being that Pan Am sued him to take it off. So, what they do is they push you, the mainstream pushes you out into a marginalized space, and then they demonize that space. That's exactly what happened with me at RT. It's also, by the way, happened to Ramparts, which I forget whether it was Time Magazine or Spiro Agnew or somebody said there was a bomb in every issue. That's what they always do.
That was author and journalist Chris Hedges speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the removal of his entire collection of shows from YouTube. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all the Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Steve Zelter and Paulina Basilia. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Paulina Basilia, and Steve Zelter. You can find this in all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. A first-of-its-kind examination of the coronavirus pandemic's impact on low-income communities shows that COVID-19 has been twice as deadly in poor counties as in wealthy ones. According to a study released today by the Poor People's Campaign, the 300 counties with the highest death rates have an average poverty rate of 45% and household median incomes on average $23,000 lower than in counties with lower rates of COVID-19. Reverend Dr. William Barber II, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, says what the report reveals is a damning indictment of the U.S. government's pandemic response. Quote, "The neglect of poor and low-wealth people in this country during a pandemic is immoral, shocking, and unjust, especially in light of the trillions of dollars that profit-driven entities received." End quote. President Joe Biden today joined a growing chorus of world leaders condemning Russia after horrifying scenes of mass graves and murdered civilians in Ukraine emerged over the weekend. Human Rights Watch said yesterday that it had documented a series of abuses allegedly committed by Russian forces in Ukraine, including sexual assault and murder. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of genocide after his government reported a massacre in the town of Bucha, northwest of the capital, Kyiv. President Biden called for a war crimes trial against Russian President Vladimir Putin and called for more sanctions against Russia. NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg said the violence was, quote, "horrific and absolutely unacceptable," end quote. And United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said an independent probe into the killings is essential. At least 1,400 civilians have been killed in Ukraine since the Russian invasion began, the UN said today, warning that the actual death toll is likely much higher. Of those who died, at least 121 were children. 2 days of torrential rains have resulted in landslides and flooding across the Brazilian state of Rio de Janeiro, causing the deaths of 14 people, 7 of whom were children, as climate change and deforestation take their toll on the equatorial country. This comes 6 weeks after devastating landslides claimed the lives of 233 people, also in Rio de Janeiro state. Far-right Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who has been criticized for his policies on environmental and indigenous rights, saw his approval rating plummet in recent weeks to just 24%. Meanwhile, recent polls show his political rival from the left-wing Workers' Party, former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, leading ahead of Brazil's next October election with 45% of the vote. And global temperatures will shoot past key danger thresholds unless greenhouse gas emissions are sharply curtailed, according to the latest report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. With Earth having already heated up 1.1 degrees Celsius since pre-industrial times, the world's economies have very little wiggle room to reach their optimistic goal of limiting warming to just 1.5 degrees Celsius. The report's co-chair, James Skia of Imperial College London, told the AP that, quote, "If we continue acting as we are now, we're not even going to limit warming to 2 degrees, never mind 1.5 degrees, end quote. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the report a, quote, file of shame, cataloging the empty pledges that put us firmly on track